Willkommen zu Das ist Kunst, dem Podcast der Deichtorhallen Hamburg. Ich bin Jumoke Olusanmi. In der heutigen Folge geht es um Andrea Orejarena und Caleb Stein. Das Duo aus New York beschäftigt sich in seiner aktuellen fotografischen Arbeit mit viralen Desinformationskampagnen und Verschwörungstheorien in den USA. Dafür haben Orejarena und Stein Orte fotografiert, über die im Internet geheimnisvolle Geschichten kursieren.
We're very interested in photography's relationship to veracity and the assumption that a photograph can ever tell a truth or a full truth.
Können Fotos die Wahrheit erzählen? Tactics and Mythologies, so heißt die aktuelle Ausstellung von Andrea Orejarena und Caleb Stein, die gerade im Foxy zu sehen ist. Im Gespräch berichtet das Duo von einer kalifornischen Stadt, die nie gebaut wurde und in der trotzdem Häuser verkauft wurden. Wie der Alltag in einer Marsstation aussieht und warum für sie die Arbeit im Kollektiv so wichtig ist. Wir haben das Gespräch auf Englisch geführt.
You are the same age. You both emigrated to the US as children from Colombia and from Great Britain. Are there more things you have in common?
Yeah, there's some very bizarre synchronicities. So we both arrived in the US very close to 9/11. Andrea is 2 days older than me. Her birthday is October 12th, 1994. Mine is October 14th, 1994. And our fathers both live in Notting Hill. My father in London's Notting Hill. And my father-in-law in Notting Hill in Florida, which is a gated community in Florida. It's bizarre,
it's wild,
these sorts
though.
Of things.
It's
I mean, it's almost corny how neat some of these synchronicities are.
Hmm. So you seem to have a knack for unbelievable stories, I guess.
You're right, yeah.
They're everywhere.
If you look for them, I guess you'll find a lot. But I think it's like with you guys, it's special, though.
Yeah, I feel like one of the most common phrases I'd say when I call a friend, I'm like, you can't make this up. I'm about to tell you something I literally cannot make up. And that kind of feels like that happens to us a lot. Like you just can't make up some synchronicities.
Your actual exhibition is called Tactics and Mythologies. What kind of mythologies are you interested in?
We're specifically interested for this project. I mean, generally, we're interested in all mythologies. But in this project, there's a sweet spot of moments in which there's a myth, a constructed truth, or some kind of simulation that you can see the facade. So there's a certain level of effort placed to see, to create this illusion. However, there's a certain level of just allowing the illusion to be an illusion. So, for example, we can look at one of the photographs, the aerial view of California City. So much effort went into creating this American, like, blueprint of a perfect American town. The avenues were named, the property was sold. And then this company that created all of this and sold the land suddenly disappeared with all the money. And later they excavated and found that there was no infrastructure underneath. So they never had the intention to build anything to begin with. And that's that sweet spot where it's just like there's this buildup, but then to a certain point, and then the facade is there as well. And all of the backstory of this construction of truth and almost not even fully going all the way to hide the construction aspect, that really is what we're following with American Glitch.
So American Glitch is one part of the exhibition we're seeing right now in the Foxy.
Mm-hmm.
For this project, you visited different places, which all have a similar structure maybe of a narrative which is behind that. Could you give another example of what places you found or what places you were interested for this project?
Yeah, another one was a fake Iraqi village that's built in the middle of the Mojave Desert in California. And you quite literally do drive through California Desert and suddenly that looks like it doesn't belong. You're like, what's going on here? And it's actually a fake Iraqi village that the army built to train their soldiers. And they actually hired, outsourced to a Hollywood production designer to design the set, who designed sets to design this fake town. And when we were there visiting the first time, I remember they had these actors who were selling fake fruit to the soldiers while they were training. And then later, we were invited to come back several months after. And when we came back the second time, it was the exact same day that the Ukraine situation had just broken out. And the actors were suddenly all blonde. And even the fake fruit had changed. Yeah, this is one of the other locations.
Or the Mars Desert Research Station in Utah, which is rumored to be primarily funded by the Elon Musk Foundation.
It's a rumor. We don't know.
Well, I say rumor because we don't know the extent of the involvement. But when we first heard about it, we heard a story that we still don't know if it's true or false. And there was this husband and wife, both scientists, who decided to participate in the simulations that they host at this Mars simulation site. It's basically a place where they do psychological conditioning. And you eat space food and you dress up in a spacesuit and you can only go outside for a couple hours a day, the amount of time that one would have oxygen. Anyway, during this particular simulation, the female scientist went on an expedition. She left the hub. And while she was out, her glove fell off. And so she had to radio back to headquarters to say, my glove has fallen off. Technically, this would mean that I would be breaking sim. Can I come back or not? I put it right back on, and my oxygen was flowing the whole time. Everyone immediately said yes, except for the husband, the other scientist, who voted her off the island. And we still don't know if this is true or not, but it kind of compelled us to travel to the space to photograph the exterior. But we weren't allowed to go in. Actually, when we photographed the exterior, they came out in spacesuits to tell us to go away. And so the New York Times commissioned us to go back, and then we lived in the Mars habitat for 5 days.
Wearing also spacesuits, I guess.
Whenever we went outside.
Just when you were outside.
So they simulated as if we actually were on Mars. So we're in this dome that has oxygen. And technically they have these spacesuits that we would only have enough oxygen to go out for 3 hours a day, realistically. So that's how long we were actually allowed to go outside of the dome while we were there wearing the spacesuits.
And with how many people were you living there?
I think it was about 12.
And how long were they there?
I think it varies. Some of the simulations are 2 weeks. Some of them are 3 weeks.
Yeah.
I think the maximum is 3 weeks.
And what are they experiencing in this stations? So you said it's about psychological effects on living in a station like this. But are they, I don't know, do they have to fulfill a special set of tasks or is it just
everyone comes, I guess they curate the group and everyone submits an application with their intention of what they plan to do. Actually, Cable and I would argue were the least prepared to be part of the simulation because a lot of these people have a background that actually allows them to kind of be more equipped to handle situations like this. Like one of them was a training aero engineer. And he wants to be an astronaut. And he went there to further develop a project he was already doing on creating. He was able to use bacteria to create more food and with a lot of nutrients. I believe with spirulina or something like that, without oxygen. And so it was quite incredible what he was doing. And a lot of the projects that they do there are also not only for like living in space, but also to live better on Earth.
Right.
But someone else had been in the army, and now he had this, he was creating this almost bus that was self-sustainable, had its own water situation, its own farm, and even fish farm inside of it, which is really cool. So everyone just had their own thing. Somebody that we were living with was one of the first team members for SpaceX. Yeah, and so that was kind of wild, yeah.
And how are these people, like, monitored psychologically? Do they have, like, I don't know, therapy sessions? Or are they just, like, observed from some kind of, I don't know, hidden psychology team?
I still don't know if we were observed. If we were, I have no idea about it. But the kind of self-monitoring.
Yeah,
kind of like beehive mentality. That was wild. Yeah.
And there was a crew that was stationed on Earth, quote unquote. And the captain had to write up daily reports. And right. So there would be discussion within the group who was participating in the simulation to formulate those reports. And I think that that process, in a way, was, I mean, you could say it was some sort of therapy, or at least some kind of taking stock of the day. But what we saw was that very quickly a crack becomes a hole. Whatever tensions people came in with, they grew considerably. And the reality is that living on Mars would be incredibly uncomfortable.
In which sense?
I mean, in every sense.
Yeah.
But it's still a beautiful sentiment. It's kind of a utopian sentiment to think that there are people who want to put themselves in an extreme situation, like Andrea said, as a way to kind of report back to a more normal quotidian situation. And I think that throughout humanity, I mean, that exercise has been very fruitful. So I respect it, and we both do. Not cynical about it, but it was incredibly uncomfortable.
When you got out there, what did it feel like to not living in an illusion anymore?
Well, we got back in our car and we drove to the nearest town, which is called Hanksville, and we promptly ordered a very large steak and couldn't have been more relieved.
We've been eating space food.
Yeah, dehydrated space food. So disgusting. It's really, really horrible. I mean, they had such a sweet, upbeat mentality about it, but I think I'm just someone who's not fit for space travel, clearly.
You said you're interested in stories which have, like, yeah, so there's some kind of facade, but there's also a lot of work behind this facade to hold up the facade. And Andrea, you studied cognitive science
as well. Yeah.
Can you talk us through what is cognitive science,
yeah,
and maybe is there a relationship to?
Yeah, I studied cognitive science and art. And cognitive science is basically AI with philosophy and computer science. And so basically we were just coding networks, neural networks, trying to create artificial intelligence and understand the ethics behind it as well, around the AI and also humans as well. And I mean, what I know the most about that background actually is that we have absolutely no control over the neural networks. It's just like basically what you code. It just, you create, almost like I heard someone once reference it as like a child, like having a child. As much as you can raise the child and try to teach them and mold them in these things, they're just going to one day just do something. You're like, where did you get that from? Or what, you know, you can't really force it to do anything. You're just letting it, like trying to give it tools and letting it be. And that's kind of what we were working with at the time.
Before I ask about your archive, could you just shortly explain what is a glitch actually?
I think a glitch is a rupture in perception. I think that the way that Andrea and I have discussed it is that in many ways it's an update for the internet AI era of conceptions of the uncanny or the surreal that have been around forever. And I think that it's often meant as something that reveals a hidden structure or as a joke about how conspiracy theorists think that they have the inside scoop on what is really happening. And I think that while conspiracy theories are often meant in a very earnest way, the cultural use of something being a glitch is often meant in some sort of satirical cultural protest to the moment that we're living in and the ocean of images that we're surrounded by and all of the misinformation. So it's a very broad framework that we've been very engaged with for the last 5 years.
I also would like to add that it has to do with, for us as well, we talked about expectation and assumptions. So for a glitch, it's almost when your expectation has a hiccup. Of just, you know, you're driving through the American road and you suddenly see something that you're like, what is that? That is not what I expect to see. And then as you follow this almost like string or like a loophole of it, then the less you expect what's happening, the more uncanny it feels, and the less answers you can give for why it's there, the more of a glitch it is.
You mentioned the archive as part of your exhibition. What images make up this archive?
I mean, the archive consists of images that have been posted and reposted thousands or millions of times and that have been tagged as a glitch in real life, or moments where people are jokingly pointing to a blurring line between the physical world and the virtual world. And a lot of it, on a visual level, is informed by video game glitches or screen errors or cultural phenomena like The Matrix or The Truman Show or Pleasantville.
And could you give an example for one of these photos or for different kinds of photos?
Yeah, some of the images, for example, are angels in the clouds, but that uncannily look like angels or some kind of spiritual feature. And then oftentimes we'll see the same angel figure in the cloud photographed from different angles. So you can kind of spot that this was a moment that people all over that vicinity noticed as uncanny and started photographing and started posting online. And then we would read sometimes the comment sections of the post and see other people posting their version of it. And sometimes we'd see the same image again, but just a different pixelation. So now it looks like this is the almost fingerprint. The pixels are the fingerprint of how many times this image has been circulated and the lifeline that it's had on the internet. And so it just, some of them are these repeated tropes or UFO sightings. So it can go from the spiritual to the uncanny to sometimes they're just humorous, like a doppelganger. Or a doppelganger cat, or one of our favorite ones. We have two favorites. One of them is the banana, right? There's a banana that's perfectly, I always confuse, is it ripe or unripe?
It's pretty ripe.
It's ripe. It's completely yellow, right? It's in perfect shape. And it's in a concrete stairs. So it's been there for a while. It's concrete. It's dried. But this banana is fine, and it's there. And so that's one of our favorite glitches. And the other one is this camouflaged soldier lying on a sofa that perfectly matches his camouflage, like better than being out in some kind of natural setting. Like,
he's lying face down.
Yeah.
Do you remember when planking was a thing?
No,
there was
this
thing
in New York, planking is glitch.
People would, they would kind of balance, say like on a garbage can, but completely face down, their body totally straight horizontally, or they would balance on a metal structure that you would lock your bike to, but they would just balance on it in a completely straight way that makes absolutely no sense.
And
it was a very, very funny phenomenon. At least I remember it, like just growing up in New York, that me and my friends would do that.
All over the U.S. It happened in Florida as well. I remember it was around high school in the summer when planking was very popular. my summer job, I used to work at Abercrombie in the clothing store. Not that I stand behind any of the politics behind it, but it was an easy summer job to get. And when the store would close, we would just like record ourselves planking, so just lying straight on the most absurd surfaces where you wouldn't ever find anyone lying or lying perfectly straight. Yeah. That's glitch, actually. If you were to see that out of context, you'd be like, what's going on?
It is glitch. But, I mean, the thing about a lot of the photographs from this archive that we developed is that they're really great photographs. I mean, we wish that we'd made a lot of these photographs.
Yeah. Our favorite photographer is anonymous. Mm. Yeah.
And I think that there's a reason that they've been circulated so successfully. You know, they're very, a lot of them, they're just very clear and direct. Mm-hmm. The compositions are very bold and simple. But it's difficult to be simple with photography.
Mm-hmm.
You know, to actually not be complicated and to just get to the point and to have the confidence to just get to the point, to make the point succinctly. And I think that's the reason that people from such a wide range of backgrounds resonate with these images and reshare them. And when Andrea was mentioning the kind of tracking of certain images, the other way in which these images circulate is that as they circulate, people modify them, or AI modifies them. So, for example, there's this one image of 8 rainbows in a section of the forest right by a highway in the US. And in a cube, we've organized it so that it's one slide away from the exact same composition and background, but it's only got 3 rainbows. So someone has decided to just run it through AI or through Photoshop or Generative Fill or whichever bit of software, and they've kind of made it their own.
But you never know if it's like if somebody really saw that or if it's made up.
Yeah, we have no idea from the beginning whether it's real or not.
Liebe HörerInnen, bevor es an dieser Stelle mit dem Gespräch weitergeht, möchte ich euch auf ein neues Format hinweisen, die Das ist Kunst-Shorties. Und um euch zu erklären, was es genau damit auf sich hat, sind Julia Schulze-Darup und Matthias Schönebäumer zu mir ins Studio gekommen. Hallo Julia, hallo Matthias.
Hallo Jumoke.
Hallo.
Ihr beiden moderiert ja die Shorties, aber was ist denn überhaupt ein Shorty?
Ja, du kennst es vielleicht. Man hat Zeit und Lust auf Kunst, möchte eine Ausstellung in den Deichtorhallen besuchen, ist sich aber noch nicht so sicher, ob die Ausstellung denn wirklich überhaupt was für einen ist.
Meist stellen sich ja dann auch immer wieder dieselben Fragen. Also, wer sind eigentlich die KünstlerInnen? Worum geht's in der Ausstellung überhaupt? Und muss ich vor meinem Besuch irgendwas wissen?
Und genau diese Fragen beantworten wir in den Shorties. Und das natürlich kurz und knapp, wie der Name schon sagt.
Wann gibt es denn die neuen Shorties zu hören?
Die Shorties erscheinen zu jeder neuen Ausstellung in den Deichtorhallen. Sie sind also der perfekte Einstieg für den Ausstellungsbesuch und ihr findet sie überall, wo es Podcasts gibt.
Vielen Dank, Julia und Matthias, dass ihr vorbeigekommen seid. Und hier geht es jetzt weiter mit meinem Gespräch bei Das ist Kunst.
If I understood it right, the base for a road trip you made looking for places with uncanny stories were photos from the internet, right?
Absolutely, yeah.
Which expectation did you have, actually, when you went on this road trip?
That's a good question.
Well, I mean, we expected that it would be very romantic, that we would learn something about ourselves, that there would be some sort of great journey that we would go on, that we would come away stronger from. And if I'm being honest, the road trip very nearly broke both of us. I mean, we lived out of our car for 6 months, even though there are pockets within the US that are very open. I would not describe the US as a space that's particularly open to a Jew and a Colombian traveling across the country in a tiny car. And we kind of had to negotiate this inherited mythology with the reality that we were experiencing. You know, one of the things that we learned later was that, for example, Joel Sternfeld, who's a very great American photographer, kind of a pioneer of new color photography in the US. And we heard from someone that even though he's sort of known for this great American road trip project, that he never spent more than 2 weeks on the road at a given time. And so it's not only the mythology of the country and what it has to offer you, but more specifically, it's the mythology of the artist that goes to the country to look for their work and how nourishing that is. The reality is that it's very difficult. And so, yeah, it was a shock to the system in a way.
Yeah, often you hear the artist, and when we were doing our visual research, we of course named the title of the project is American Glitch, because we were very aware that we were entering in this conversation of the grand American road trip in photography, often by expats. And you often hear them saying, oh yeah, I did this project for years and I was on the road for years. And then you talk to their interns, as Caleb said, and their assistants at the time, and they're like, he did not. He did 2 weeks max and had to come back home. And there is something, I think, important in being honest about how hard it is, because I wish they had been honest before we'd gone on the road trip, because I would have done it differently.
I think I was also naive, and I wanted it to be something that it couldn't be. At least not in 2020.
And on a personal level, you just said you didn't feel welcome at a lot of spaces. Yeah. And I was wondering, what is your perception now, a different one to your, it's the place where you live, right? What did it do to your being American, quote unquote?
Well, we're not American. You know, I mean, both of us have had discussions about this idea of like a third culture kid. You know, when you're not really from one place, you're not really from another, but you've made it work. And I think that that's actually a condition that we've both experienced in our own way. And I think it actually sets us up very well for collaboration, because I think it enables us to be quite open to different perspectives. And to kind of sit with that kind of wandering quality.
I love that term, third culture kid, because it really does distill that feeling of one foot in each culture, but also it's only one foot, so it's never both, like other people around you might have. But I'd also say there are parts of the U.S. that I do like, that I think are welcoming. There, as much xenophobia as there is right now around the Trump elections and what's coming up, it's also one of the spaces that I've been so far where actually I do have a lot of friends from all over in New York. And that's very special, the melting pot sensation that you have there. And I actually haven't seen it in other countries to the extent that I have seen it in New York as well.
We both love aspects of the U.S., especially what happens in places like New York City or L.A. or, you know, Austin, or places that are open to difference. And, I mean, the thing about New York is that if you approach people with respect and kindness, they give it back to you in a big way. If you don't, they jump down your throat. But it's, I mean, we're both very comfortable in New York. You know, it's a special place.
New York is a, how do you say, third culture place, maybe?
Totally.
Yeah, I think you're right.
It's like a city on a hill without its problems. It's fraught. But it gives us some hope for the U.S. And you know, early in the development of American Glitch, we had a meal with David Campany, who wrote the introduction for the book, and he's a really brilliant curator and writer. And we were describing this to him, and he said, well, to be critical of your country is to love it. And I think that rings true with both of us, because if you don't care, then you don't bother to be critical of something. It's an act of care.
This is your first solo exhibition in Europe. How is the perception different from the U.S. towards your work? Do you already have a feeling?
I think we're still learning. I'm not sure that I could answer that yet.
But I think what I have enjoyed about the openings that we've had, both in the U.S. and now here, is that oftentimes people come to me and still say, I've been there. Mm. I have a story. And they tell me a story that I still have not heard. So it's a new story from these locations that we've already heard all these myths from. And regardless of where we go, there's always someone who's been there, someone who has their own story. They've had their own sightings there. Yeah, and then oftentimes they come to us with their own glitches that they've experienced in their life.
Do you spend a lot of time on the internet, like searching for glitches?
So much time.
Or, yeah, that's how is your mythology about, mythology, you'd say that, about finding this kind of pictures?
I mean...
Or stories.
One approach is just to see what Google's algorithms will suggest to you. Another is just to spend, to really inhabit the internet as if it was a physical space and just to move around in it and discover within it the way that you would if you were photographing on the street. And then with time, you find things. But it's taken years to build the archive. And then
so even... How big is your archive?
It's about 2,000 glitch in real life images, 60 videos, and maybe 100 stories. Some of them are just a sentence long. Our favorite...
Like a tweet.
Yeah, it's like a tweet. Our favorite is, I once bit into a banana and the soundbite of an apple played. And that's actually the name of the video installation at the Deichtorhallen right now. And, you know, I think it's important that it's an archive that has moving images and still images, because the understanding of what a glitch is super different if it's in movement or not. It's almost like if you think about glitch as a magic trick, if it's a still image, it's a very quick magic trick. You don't have to keep people's attention for very long. If it's a moving image, you have to prove it over time. But then you could pause something that is glitching in movement, and as a still image, it might look completely normal, whereas the still glitch has to contain its whole narrative within one frame. So these sorts of differences are really interesting to us. And then we sort of come back to it and we check because, you know, especially since AI has exploded, these things are being generated exponentially. So the point of the archive is that it grows with time.
Can you say something about your visual language you decided on approaching when you were searching or when you were visiting this glitch places?
Absolutely. We're very interested in photography's relationship to veracity and the assumption that a photograph can ever tell a truth or a full truth, or if, you know. And I actually think that people often talk about how dangerous it is now that you don't know if images are manipulated, but actually images have been manipulated since the beginning of photography. And I think it's actually quite healthy now that now we look at images and look for the manipulation, or we look for the specific perspective and not just assume that this is one objective truth. And so this is something that we're exploring visually through American Glitch, through our conceptual almost like performance of like going out to photograph these sites of simulation and myth with the most truthful language possible. And so we're using the canonical like frontal, almost Dusseldorf aesthetic, the surveillance state photography documentation aesthetic, and all of trying to like just explore what language is used to construct truth through photography.
Sorry, I just have a question. If you refer to the Dusseldorf photography, could you describe this aesthetic of this Dusseldorf?
Yeah, I mean...
Photography.
Yeah, I feel like... I mean, what would you say, Caleb? It's like oftentimes like Gursky's or like... Just like they seem to be straight, very frontal, straight, extremely formal. Which is very hard. The more simple and frontal, the harder it is to make it formal. The more fun it is as well. How else would you elaborate on that, Caleb?
I mean, I think one element of it, I completely agree with everything you've said. One additional element is that there's an enormous amount of detail, which I think typically suggests that there's information that can be taken from it. And I think that's part of the argument that it makes for itself.
It tries to prove that it's real and documentary.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Unfictional.
Unfictional, that's a good
word. That's a good word. I like that word.
So is that the reason the file formats are all also part of the title? Or we get to know with what kind of camera you make the photos?
I think it's just a way of acknowledging that it all exists within a digital sphere.
The camera we use is a huge conceptual part of what of the work we do, because we chose the Hasselblad because of its color treatment, and the way that it documents it also is a visual language, yes, in Dusseldorf school, but also in stylized, constructed images already. And so we think about advertising, we think about fashion, we think about truthful stories. Like, it's like when you build something and then try to photograph it as if it wasn't built. That was kind of a camera that we sought out, that we sought for that.
I think generally we start with a question or a set of questions or a feeling, and then we think about the right tools or materials or forms to explore that. So instead of leading with a style or a process, the thing that we value is the concept and the refining of that concept through a material and through a form.
And I just realized we didn't actually answer your question about the title. It's actually a collaboration with Nadine and Sarah at the Dijkstra Hallen. They had the idea to add the tip, and we thought it was brilliant. And I think we love collaboration, and the project really is about the collective. The cubes are about almost looking at the internet as a Jungian subconscious or mirror to our society right now and how we collectively create this archive. And we often talk about how a lot of artists, the myth of like the singular artist and how there's always a community behind them building up everything and supporting and also contributing to like often the details of this. And that is an example of one of them. Yeah, the titles of it.
And that's interesting because the other day I was talking to another artist and I have the impression that it's like it's more talked about now, right now, from a younger generation of artists who are like demystifying this idea of the genius who goes in his closet and comes out with this big idea.
And it takes a village.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, when you talked about the road trip and the romantic notion and everything and the idea or the myth or the illusion, you think people really do that and then you find out they didn't do that and you're really like, so what? Why am I doing that actually?
Exactly. It's an impossible task. Just like the impossible task of truth and photography.
Yeah, exactly. And we'd be so much happier if we treated photography as something that was super ambiguous and that there was still a lot of potential within that ambiguity. I mean, instead of burdening it with this role of truth, you know, in the same way, I mean, to acknowledge collaboration or support, it doesn't diminish one's work. I mean, these are things that they're different, but I think it's the same emotion behind them that leads to these kind of these absurd ways of making art. It's not very healthy.
I was wondering if you could say something about your shared interests in communities. So what is fascinating for you about observing people living in different communities? Because we talked about the Mars station, we talked about the Confederates, we talked about like different, how do I say, like agreements of an illusion or maybe also a reality. What is, maybe I answered my own question, but is that what's interesting to you?
I really like that agreements on illusions.
That's beautiful.
And realities.
That's a really lovely way of thinking
it's
about it.
It's very poetic, yeah.
I think you have answered the question.
Yeah, I feel like anything I say can't stand up to that.
Okay. You also lived in Vietnam for 2 years. How come you came there? And how come you worked on this specific project? Could you just give a short idea of what did you do, what you did there?
We're very moved by Edward Lee Sun's quote, "I can change through exchange." And we visited this space called Lang Huni first when we were in university before we did the project. And they took us to this location that had these residents who were affected by the chemical used in the U.S. Vietnam War. And they're veterans and their descendants. And at the very beginning, we told the professors, Caleb and I, and also a lot of our peers in that program, why are we going here? Like, is that okay? Like, we shouldn't be going into these spaces for like a day. Like, this isn't like any kind of tourism or anything, you know? And we actually had a lot of problems with how the program was handling that. And they just basically told us, like, you have to go or you'll fail. And so we all had to go. And we told the veterans that when we got there. We're like, how do you feel about us being here? Like, you please be honest. Like, you know, like with all these university students being brought here, like, and they just said, they kind of like chuckled and they said, don't worry, we won the war, you know? And it was just kind of small notes like that made us realize that, you know, like it's actually, what were we so worried about in that sense? And then we realized that actually it comes from another conversation that we had with someone there that they told us, you know, that image of the execution, the famous execution image of the man being executed from the Vietnam War. She said, you know, he was like smiling right before that frame. Like he actually wasn't fully, like he was proud to be dying for his country in that moment. And that wasn't the image that was circulated of him or of us collectively. And that image contributed to why also we were coming in hesitant as well. And it's this sensationalistic view that was showed, and actually something that had we not gone and talked to them in person, we wouldn't have had this exchange. And it was well-meaning at the beginning. We were trying to not be disrespectful by wondering if we should be coming in just one day helicoptering it or not. And then we realized actually we need to come back. And it was funny telling the program that after the protest that we made as students, you know, actually we have to go back now. And then we continued going back to students. And actually at the end of that, we said, we have to come back after we graduate. We want to do something. We want to do a collaboration between us and them. And we actually hadn't even picked the medium because we thought to even pick the medium before coming is not fully the collaboration we wanted. We wanted to land there and pick it together. And so we came back and we asked if anybody wanted to collaborate with us. And a lot of the people that did want to were part of the deaf community. And we ended up learning Vietnamese sign language. And the title, Long Time No See, actually is originally in sign language. It's kind of just it's this beautiful gesture. And we just loved it so much. We said that has to be the title. And then we translated it to English.
Caleb, can you say something about the visual language you chose for this work?
Yeah, so as Andrea mentioned, I mean, we when we came back, we were interested in the idea that the war continues to be fought through who has the biggest microphone. And I think this is actually why Nadine decided to include both bodies of work in the exhibition, is because in a way they both grapple with constructions of truth and the way that the U.S. tries to control its own narrative. And we'd seen the U.S. perspective, we'd seen some of the Vietnamese perspective, but we had not seen a collaboration. And so the first thing, before even going back, was asking them if they even wanted to collaborate with us, and then finding the forms that they felt comfortable collaborating through. So quite quickly, we realized that the third and fourth generations at Lang Huni, they loved to paint and draw. And so we established this workshop that met every day for 2 years, where they made the most beautiful, energetic, inventive works on paper. And they said that they didn't want to be defined by the war, but they wanted to kind of create allegories for it or to show their current visions. And they wanted to be photographed, so we started to photograph them, and then they would take the camera and they'd go through it. And if there was something they didn't like, they would delete it. If there was something that they loved, we would go and print it and bring it back and ask if they wanted to draw on it. And in some cases, we made photographs where they had made drawings directly onto the walls of Lang Uni. And we also collaborated with the Vietnamese veterans on this series of dreamlike video vignettes where they we brought in a green screen and they chose the backgrounds that they wanted to be associated with. There's not actually the space to show all of this at the Deitehallen, so there's a very kind of succinct version of it. But there's also an artist book that we made in 2022 in close collaboration with our friends there. And that contains all three components. But the photographs, they are black and white with ink drawings on them or ink drawings on the walls in them. And we used, you know, in the same way that Andrea mentioned that we used the Hasselblad to photograph the American landscape to participate and comment on that specific visual tradition. For Long Time No See, we chose to use the Leica because this is the camera that is historically associated with photojournalism. It's easy to use. It's quick. It's very intuitive. There's a lot of information. It's quite wide angle. This is the main camera that was used to report on the war through very sensationalistic images. And our friends told us, we don't want to be shown in any dramatic way. You know, show us hanging out. Show us wearing the new outfit that we got, or in Lang Uni's beautiful swimming pool, or in nature. And so we were interested in taking the tool and the general language of black and white documentary photography, but applying it to a context where people were, yes, they were dealing with some real shit. Objectively, there's some difficult things that they are dealing with. But they're also resilient, dynamic people that are getting on with their life, and they deserve to be shown in that way, and they want to be shown in that way. And so that's kind of how that visual language developed for the Long Time No See photographs. But it really goes back to what I said earlier, which is even though we are dealing with the tradition of documentary, we both see ourselves as conceptual artists because it starts with a question or a feeling or a subject. And typically it involves a collaboration to try to deconstruct something or to complicate an understanding of something through a collective, through the immense power and hope that a collective can bring. And then that's hopefully how you end up with a quote-unquote finished result after years. It always takes years. It always takes way longer than you would think because it just needs time.
Do you understand your approach to photography as a way of resistance?
I think it's one element of it.
Okay.
And engagement.
Engagement is maybe a more important part. It's a way of remaining open. I mean, for me, it's a form of religion because it's an act of love. It's an act of care. It's a way to be present. I mean, I seek comfort in it, the way many people seek comfort in religion.
And you, Andrea?
I can't top that.
Well, it's not about topping anything.
No, I'm kidding.
It's a very personal question.
No, I know. I'm teasing.
But it's also an answer to the question, why do you take photos?
Why do we take photos? Oh, yeah,
so it's kind of it has to do with spirituality, I guess.
Then. Yeah.
Thank you very much, Andrea. Thank you, Caleb.
Thank you so much for having
Thank
us, Jumi. Thank you.
Andrea Orecharena und Caleb Stein halten fest, welche Bilder entstehen, wenn Menschen gemeinsame Vereinbarungen über Illusionen treffen oder ihre Wahrnehmungen der Welt teilen. Fotografie ist für sie Ausdruck von Fürsorge, Achtsamkeit und Engagement. Wenn ihr interessiert seid an dem Rahmenprogramm und den Workshop-Angeboten, die zu der Ausstellung Tactics and Mythologies angeboten werden, dann guckt in die Shownotes. Hier findet ihr alle relevanten Informationen. Hinterlasst eine Bewertung, wenn euch der Podcast gefällt und empfehlt ihn gern weiter. Ihr könnt uns auch einfach schreiben an dasistkunst@deichtorhallen.de. Wir freuen uns, wenn ihr wieder dabei seid bei der nächsten Folge von Das ist Kunst, dem Podcast der Deichtorhallen in Zusammenarbeit mit Byte FM. Tschüss und bis bald, sagt Jumoko Lusami.